Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Well, one of the things that is going to be important for us during this next lockdown is to make sure that we get some fresh air, some physical activity. Personally, I like to ensure that my physical activity has a coffee at the end. So I like to walk to a coffee shop, and then I get to have the coffee to distract me from the fact that I have to walk all the way back. So that's my favourite type of exercise. I also enjoy a hike, and in the Curlis Gibson household, we define a hike as any length of walk where you need to pack food. And if you're a hungry bod, then that could be any length of walk. So I do enjoy a hike with a backpack with some food in it, even if you can't get a coffee along the way. I miss a couple of the hikes that we've enjoyed around the place. And the best sort of hike, I think, is one where you're not just getting to a good view, although you do want to be able to have, you know, that kind of, that goal of when you get to the top of the mountain or whatever it is, or to the lake that you're going through the wilderness to find. You want to have that good view. I remember we did one in Hamilton Island where when you got to the top, you had this beautiful view out over the Whitsundays. That was magnificent. But you want to have kind of beauty along the way, I think. You know, it's not just like you're kind of climbing up the stairs in a tower block until you get to the top. You know, you want to have kind of an enjoyable time along the way, and you want to have those moments where you can kind of take a break and really enjoy what's around you. And when it comes to our teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, I feel like that's sort of where we are now. We're climbing up a mountain. And Phil, if you can show that slide I began the series with, and it's okay if you can't see all the details on this, but do you remember we said that the peak of the Sermon on the Mount is in chapter 6, where Jesus teaches the Lord's Prayer, and so that all of this ethical and kind of kingdom life teaching that we are receiving is in the context and the pinnacle of worship. We are to be people who worship God as our number one priority, and our ethics, the way that we follow him, flow out of that. And so we're on our way up the side of this diagram at the moment, and let's focus in a little bit. Thanks, Phil, for the next slide. This is where we've been, where we're at the moment. We've been looking at these you have heard it said teachings. You have heard it said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. You heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. This is what we have come through so far. And Jesus has had a pattern of teaching where he has shown what there was in the law, and he has moved it to the invisible life of the heart, or he has shown where it has been twisted because of hardness of heart. So let's have a look more specifically. So we had in our first couple of weeks, so with Andrew Gifford, murder, but if anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. And then we looked at adultery last week, but it moves again not simply to the outward action that's forbidden in the law, but to the inward heart, the invisible intention upstream of the forbidden action. Anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, that is just kind of That's good psychology in a way for both of those things. You know, we know that no action just happens in and of itself, but it is all connected. We are a product of everything that we have thought and done and experienced. And so Jesus, looking at the law, says, going to the invisible life of the heart, looking at your intention, your thought life, that's going to help you not break the law down the track, but also it's going to show you the intention that God had for that law right at the beginning, that it was purity of heart, just like Jesus said in the Beatitudes. So Jesus is going upstream of these forbidden actions so that the righteousness of the kingdom exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Jesus is going upstream of each forbidden action to the invisible life of the heart and restoring the place of each of these laws in a kingdom righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And the next two that follow the same pattern, thanks Phil, next slide. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. Now, that doesn't have a let's go to the intention of the heart. What's the thought life there? There's something different going on. And I think it's probably similar to what's going on verse 33. Again, you've heard it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you've made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all. All you need to say is yes or no. And one of our younger members, I think, has pointed to that on the screen with their drawing. So thank you very much for that. Both of these patterns are the same. You've heard it said, but I tell you. But now something different. Something different is being identified. The law is still being restored to its rightful place in a kingdom righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. But here Jesus is showing that we have, because of our hardness of heart, twisted these laws to make them say what we want them to say, or to kind of undercut them or to get around them. Now, that phrase, hardness of heart, actually uses the word that we use when you've got hardened arteries or something like that, sclerosis. So that comes from Matthew 19, where Jesus said, Moses gave you that law of divorce because of your hardness of heart, because of your arteriosclerosis, if you like. We're not talking about, you know, fatty deposits and whatnot, but this is what humans do. We find as many loopholes as possible. We cliff walk, or we kind of expand where we think the cliff really is because of the way that we play with language and rules. And Jesus said, that's not funny, it's hardness of heart. And in fact, just as atherosclerosis is a leading cause of death, this hardness of heart is going to lead to your disconnection from God, your losing your humanity, your spiritual death and judgment. So Jesus is identifying in that second section the laws that have been twisted because of hardness of heart, and he's restoring the place of those laws in the kingdom righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And now we come to our passage today, and it is a really beautiful place to sit. And in fact, maybe we are a bit out of breath after going through some of those previous laws. But here, we're kind of stopped in our tracks anyway, because what Jesus says now is just so, so far beyond just kind of good psychology or showing where things have been twisted. So let's have a look what we're looking at today in the same pattern. You've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. You've heard it that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Well, what is happening here? Because this sounds like Jesus is not simply restoring the place of the law, but kind of contradicting it. You know, if there was eye for an eye, but now you're not to do that. Or before you're allowed to hate your enemy, but now you're not allowed to do that. Well, what's happening here? In what way is Jesus restoring these laws into a righteousness, a kingdom righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees? Well, let's take a look at them together. Thanks, Phil. We can come out of the slides for a little bit. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's really been the basis for a lot of law codes around the world, this retributive justice that is a retaliation that is like for like. So, you know, if you like Latin, which I do just because I think it makes me look cool, which is very wrong-headed probably. Lex talionis is the law of like for like. So that is, if an injury is done for you, God said in Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy 24 and those other references that I had for you there, sorry, Leviticus 24 and Deuteronomy 19, other way around, that to stop an escalation of violence and revenge, that only like-for-like punishment for injury should be meted out. So this was to ensure that, well, you punch me in the face, I cut your head off, I cut your... Anyway, this is not children-friendly. Stop. This is to stop an escalation that happens when our pride is wounded, let alone our body is wounded. If something is taken from us, we want to not simply restore it, but we want to hurt the other person as well. And so God put this law in place, this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, to say if you've lost something, yes, justice must be done. It must be restored to you, or the person should experience justice for what has been done to you. But this must not be an escalating spiral of revenge. The problem is, of course, that violence never able to stop violence. I think it was Gandhi that said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And the Pharisees and the scribes, of course they knew, and they weren't advocating violence. But what they were saying was, rather than this being a limitation on human violence, this was an excuse for revenge. And because Jesus is saying, we are looking for a kingdom people who will bring about those beatitude characteristics on the earth, peacemaking, pure in heart, meek, generous. Because we're looking for that, then a revenge culture can never create that. And in fact, human beings can never bring about peace through those actions of revenge. But the scribes and the Pharisees were saying, well, the law said, it's okay, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. If someone wrongs you, make sure you insist upon your rights and that justice is done. Now, I wonder if that sounds familiar to you. Really, the law has been the basis for human rights. The Mosaic law has been the basis of human rights in the West. And yet we've now moved to a situation where the demanding of our rights comes above everything else. So relational righteousness is put to the side because my rights are the only thing that's sort of guiding me through what is good or bad in this world. But Jesus comes to us and he says, that's not going to work. That won't create the world that you were made for, that you're looking for, that all the stories, all the songs are trying to grasp. That happy ending, that peace, that things put right. Revenge and retaliation is not going to bring that about. And so he says this really just mind-blowing statement. Do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. I wonder if you're feeling uncomfortable right now. Is Jesus asking me to be just a doormat? Where does my kind of sense of self and my protection and my vulnerability, where does that sit in all of this? Well, let me bring you to the next slide, because I want to talk to you about what is really going on here. So when Jesus says, when Jesus says, do not resist, what is he talking about? Well, first of all, we might say he's saying, do not violently resist, okay? Do not answer violence with violence or injustice with injustice, okay? And so maybe we think, okay, I don't know if you've ever tried to deal with a toddler that you're trying to get to go somewhere, and they might not be violently resisting you, but they go what I like to call boneless. Have you ever seen a toddler go boneless? And you can't, there's nothing you can do with them. They become a jellyfish, and you can't pick them up and put them into the stroller or whatever it is, or the car seat. You can't get them out of the car seat. You can't get them to do whatever it is that you need them to do. Not because they're kicking and fighting and biting, but because they've gone boneless. And we did have a saying, don't go boneless, don't go boneless, in the Curlis Gibson household. I think it came from TV, which is pretty much where everything comes from. And the Bible in the Curlis Gibson household. So we're not talking about just going boneless, right? We're not talking about if someone slaps you on the right cheek, just going, okay, fine, and just walking away. We're not talking about if anyone, forces you to go 1 mile, don't resist them, but just go boneless. Just sit there on the ground. You haven't fought back. We're not just talking about don't violently resist. Jesus is actually, when you look at the examples that he's giving here, he's saying, be ready for an act of grace. Now, that's quite something. In each of these examples, the person hasn't done nothing. They haven't gone boneless. Don't go boneless. That's the only thing you're going to remember from this. So it's okay. That's okay. Be ready for an act of grace. So if someone slaps you on the right cheek, and the right cheek means that the person, if they're slapping you with their right hand, gives you a backhander, right? This is humiliation. This is an act of absolute shaming of one who you are considering lower than yourself. So you could, of course, say, I'm just going to walk away. But Jesus says, turn to them the other cheek also. Now, I did hear it said that someone interpreted this as saying, turn to them the cheek that they might give you a kiss on. So say, my relational righteousness is still there for you. You know, you've slapped me, but I am still here. You know, what Danny Silk would say, keep your love on. You know, I'm still here in this. And actually, I mean, look, that's fantastic advice for conflict, is to keep the relational lines open. Absolutely. But I don't think that's exactly what's happening here. I think it's more likely that they're saying, okay, something's going on. You really want to hit me. All right. Now, can you hit me as an equal? Can you hit me on the cheek that maybe you would have given me a kiss on? Can you hit me open-palmed, not a backhander? Can you hit me as an equal? Can you see me as a human being, just like you, made in the image of God? Can your violence continue if you see me as dignified as you are, as an equal? And maybe it opens the person's eyes. Maybe it doesn't. Secondly, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. Obviously, the coat is the thing. You know, you couldn't give that in pledge overnight. It needed to be returned because that was the thing that kept you warm. I took mine off to preach and I'm half regretting it. So this is a way of saying, okay, all right, you're taking my shirt. Can you see that I'm not only willing to give you more, but here is my coat. Are you going to return it before night is through? Are you believing that you are truly righteous in what you're doing? Is this suing me? Is this really according to the law? It's interesting that Paul would say in 1 Corinthians, when he's talking to Christians who are suing each other, and he says, why not rather be wronged than to go through this process of demanding your rights, breaking relationships, and bringing revenge? Why not rather be wronged? And isn't that exactly what Jesus is saying here? Can you put aside your rights, Christian, and restore relational righteousness? Can you be a powerful peacemaker? Can you live out a dignified mercy that opens eyes, that makes the perpetrator of the violent or the unjust act, makes them stop and think? Can you change the game? If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. That is, it was said that Roman soldiers could demand that any citizen of the Roman Empire could carry their stuff, could accompany them for a mile to assist them in their task. And of course, they were more likely to ask that of people who had no social status. And so for a Jewish person who was part of the occupied nation, they were often asked. And Tim Mackey, who I don't know if you've heard of the Bible Project, it's just a fantastic way of analyzing the scriptures in the big picture. I love looking at patterns within the scriptures. You've probably worked that out already. He says that you say to the Roman soldier here, after 1 mile, I can see that you must be really tired. Let me carry your pack for you for another mile. Now, possibly the soldier thinks, oh, I'm not allowed to do that. Possibly the soldier says, oh, why did I ask you to do that in the first place? Am I tired? Or was I just being an absolute bully? This is how Jesus says, you change the game through non-resistance. It's non-violent, yes, but it's not going boneless. It's actually giving an act of grace becoming a powerful peacemaker. Now, thanks, Phil, we can come off the slides for a little bit. I thought about how it is that we could actually have the power to do this. And it's only possible when we know that we are citizens of the kingdom of God, where God, our Heavenly Father, is our King who provides for us. So I was thinking, well, it's okay, I don't need to demand my rights, I don't need to avoid shame or dishonor, I can lose face, because I actually know that I am an honored citizen of the kingdom. I know my honor is not actually under threat or in question, even if you backhand me to the face in this example. I don't need to retaliate or exact revenge because the king that I follow, whose kingdom I am a part of, is a king who will bring full justice for all wrongdoing on the last day. And I don't need to fear loss or deprivation because my king can supply all I need. And I'm actually part of a kingdom community that is full of generosity. If someone's taken my shirt, you know, I think that there'll be a brother or sister in the kingdom community who can supply what I need as God directs them. So when Jesus says, do not resist, he's not saying, do nothing. He's saying, change the game. And Bonhoeffer, in his Cost of Discipleship, wrote this: evil will become powerless when it finds no opposing object, no resistance in its kind, but instead is willingly born and suffered. Evil meets an opponent for which it is not a match. It can't feed off anything. You speak a new language to it, and it has no words to come back to you. Only light, as Martin Luther King said, can fight the darkness. But let's move reasonably quickly onto the second part of this. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Well, let me talk to you about that, because that sounds very concerning. If God had said in the commandments, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But in fact, we don't find any phrase in the Old Testament that says hate your enemy. We do find some injunctions to say, do not make a treaty of friendship with these people who follow other gods or who are against you. And so you can say, oh, okay. But we do find, especially in Leviticus 19, that God says, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your own people, but love your neighbor as yourself. You thought Jesus made that up, didn't you? Actually, no, it's from the Old Testament. Jesus is a man of his scriptures, and he is just breathing the Spirit into them to restore them to their rightful place. And so love your neighbor was definitely part of the Pharisees and the scribes and all the Jewish nation's code of conduct, love your neighbor. But you know that question, who is my neighbor? Well, in the context of Leviticus 19, it's really easy to read it as your fellow Israelite the whole way through. Don't defraud your fellow Israelite, it says. Don't act violently against your fellow Israelite. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so neighbor was easily defined as someone who was within your tribe. And this is exactly what you and I do today. Absolutely, 100%. I am a loving person. We are all decent people when it comes to loving those who are like us and who are nice to us or maybe who we could get something from, there's that. But not just that. You know, I'm not saying that human beings' motives at every point are selfish. We're just really good at loving the people who are in our tribe, in our nation, in our family, in our friendship group, in our whatever, demographic. And so the scribes and the Pharisees and pretty much all of us have gone, yeah, I'm very loving to those within this neighbor definition. And in fact, if someone has wronged me, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hate my enemy, push them away, punish them, and keep the good people and the bad people separate. But Jesus says, is that what God does? Is that what God has ever done? Now, we look at the Old Testament maybe and we think, well, you know, God had a special people. God had chosen the Israelites, and he really did lay it on pretty heavy on some of those other nations. But Jesus says, look at the very beginning. Look at creation. Look at the weather. Look at the sun and the rain. Did those bad people over there get drought while those good people over there got rain? Or did those bad people over there get a cloudy day while these people got a beach day? No. God's sun and God's rain blesses the good and the bad alike. The observant and the non-observant Jewish people, the pagans and the religious people, the Christians and the non-Christians, the Muslims, the whoever. I don't even want to list it because I don't want to say these are the people that we, you know, are in that category. Absolutely not. God gives his blessings, and why, you know, we need to focus on gratitude for all the things that we have, because we forget that they're the Creator God's blessings to us. A drink of water. No matter who, no matter their relationship to God or not, whether they've rejected him, whether they've said the most terrible things about them, God does not deny them that. God is a Father whose love just gives and gives and gives and gives. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? And not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Possibly you and I don't experience a lot of enemies. The people to whom Jesus was writing absolutely did. And you've seen already in these passages some of whom they were. So the Romans, the pagans, their nation was occupied and had been for hundreds of years by people who were completely opposed to their laws and their way of life, who had set up the most abominable things in their temple, who were asking them to do things for them that really went against all that they were. They had national, racial enemies. And they had people from within their midst that were traitors, betrayers, tax collectors who were selling them out. You know, we're asked to be very careful with language these days, and rightly so. And I was thinking, oh, they're the people that had sold them down the river. And that's a phrase that we ought to use with very careful concern, because it refers to those that were sold into slavery, particularly African Americans. And I think, though, that it really captures that pain of what it means to have someone from your own people taking what is yours and giving it to your enemy. That's what the tax collectors were doing. And these words are actually said to all of us, those who have experienced that terrible history of slavery, those who have had an entire race be targeted within another nation. Again, I actually don't want a list. I could. Who particular people groups might consider to be their enemies. You can probably think of some off the top of your head, and we can all do some more reading to know what really has happened in our world. You and I do have people, of course, that we find difficult. And last week we spoke about divorce and adultery, and I think that for many of us, maybe people who have hurt us sit in those categories. We've had personal betrayal. And Jesus is talking to all of us. He's talking to the Jewish people where the stakes are just so high. He's talking to you and me, the people that rub you up the wrong way, the people who've really hurt you, the people who've excluded you because of something, the people who have said things about you that are just untrue, or even if they are true, have just said them to your face and really wounded you. We all have them. And Jesus is saying, well, do you know when God said at Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself? These people are your neighbor. And in fact, that action that you are called to do, that peacemaking, that powerful peacemaking, that dignified mercy that changes the game, this is to turn enemies into neighbors. This is your job. This is what you're being empowered to do by the King. He's going to give you what you need. Can you use His grace to turn enemies into neighbors? Leviticus 19 starts with, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now, if you are anything like me and a kind of good Western evangelical, you think be holy means let's make sure we point out what the sins are of other people. Well, I don't mind admitting a few of my own, but just the surface, not really the really deep, dark ones. Thank you very much. And so we kind of talk about a holy God that is, you know, His justice and mercy and holiness and love, and that's His kind of pure thing. And so Jesus says, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect, which is really exactly the same as saying, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy, which is in Leviticus 19. But what does holiness look like? Suddenly it looks like giving the sun and the rain to the righteous and the unrighteous. Suddenly being perfect does not mean cutting off good relations with anyone who seems to be against God. And so, Phil, let's have a look at that final, second last slide, be perfect. And so really what's being said here is this. Be complete in love as your Father is complete in love. Be perfect, that is, love both your fellow Jewish neighbors and the Roman enemies in your midst, as your Father makes the sun to rise and the rain to fall on all humans. So you are to be perfect in love as your Father is perfect in love. And N.T. Wright summarizes it as, have a character that is formed by overflowing generous love. How to be complete? How to be perfect? So this idea of perfection is not one that is a kind of never get anything wrong. I mean, it is that, but the picture is really of wholeness. Holiness and wholeness, as we talked about last week. And if you really want to be holy like God, then you let your overflowing, generous love keep changing the game. You never turn your love off, no matter what comes your way. Whatever you can do to turn enemies into neighbors, that is what God is enabling you to do. Well, there's a final picture for you. This is on my wall at home, and it was a gift to me when I was ordained all those years ago, 2000 and something, five. And this is a photo, a panoramic photo of a scene from The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson. I'll leave that aside. But this picture here is called The Walk of Victory. And that's why I love it. And that's why it's on my wall. Because Jesus is not asking us to do anything here in the Sermon on the Mount that he did not do himself. And in fact, he did not prove himself. Jesus changes the game through meeting evil with sacrifice and love. Victory comes through a cross. Do you remember Isaiah 53, or other servant songs in Isaiah 40 to 55, talks about turning the cheek, being slapped, talks about having your clothes divided. These are the things that Jesus actually experienced. Jesus did all that we are being called to do. And he won the victory. It was through that resurrection, forgiveness, grace, redemption, a new kingdom world would come. We're going to share the Lord's Supper, communion, in just a few moments after we've sung together. And that is so that we know that God is not asking us to do anything that he hasn't already done for us himself. That evil has already been overcome by love. And that the way of the cross is the way of victory. So let's sing.